This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, February 5th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, how the Office of Human Concern is helping low-income residents stay warm this winter. Plus, a conversation with a cast member of I Love Lucy live on stage. The show opened last night at the Walton Arts Center.
And we take a trip to Gateway to visit Martin Greer's Candies. We'll also learn about the Lincoln Echo, an African-American newspaper in Fort Smith, and more. But first, Arkansas's U.S. senators praised passage yesterday of a five-year farm bill, which now heads to the president for his signature. It came after extensive negotiations, with much of the debate focusing on the inclusion of food stamps in the $1 trillion bill. Speaking on the Senate floor, Democrat Mark Pryor said it would be vital for the agriculture industry.
We hear every day here in the United States Senate from the business community, they want more certainty, they want more stability. Well, this bill provides that in the agriculture economy. Our farmers and our producers and others, they deserve that same certainty and stability, and this bill provides that.
Republican John Bozeman was part of the conference committee that negotiated the agreement between House and Senate versions of the bill. He told reporters after the vote that it was difficult.
But at the end of the day, I think we've got a really good product, something that we can all be proud of. As you know, these aren't Democrat or Republican issues to a large extent. It's making sure the various segments of agriculture are well represented throughout the various regions of the country. And again, having a situation where we don't have a one-size-fits-all in this complicated economy.
Passage in the Senate follows approval last week in the House of Representatives. With the vote in the Senate final, 4th District Representative Tom Cotton was the only representative of Arkansas's congressional contingent to vote against the farm bill. One in six jobs in Arkansas is connected to agriculture industry.
Governor Mike Beebe is in favor of the Arkansas legislature passing a non-fiscal bill to prevent the state from having to call a special election to fill the recently vacated office of lieutenant governor. The governor yesterday told Ruby Brock of Talk Business Arkansas that while it would take a two-thirds majority in both houses of the legislature to bring up a non-fiscal issue during the fiscal session, there seems to be bipartisan support for bringing such a bill.
If they do that early in the session next week, then I'll be able to sign that, and we won't have a special election and spend that couple $1 million to try to fill an office that would probably only be filled for about 4 months. So I anticipate that to happen, and I'll sign the bill and fully support that that effort.
Governor Beebe also said he expects something to be done about the staff of four that work in the lieutenant governor's office now that there is no one holding the office.
I mean, if you're not going to have the office, I don't know why you got the staff. I mean, those are good people. Nobody's trying to be mean to those folks. But at the same time, the people of Arkansas would find it a little bit, unusual to keep a staff for an office that doesn't exist or that doesn't have an incumbent in it.
Former Lieutenant Governor Mark Dar officially resigned Friday afternoon after admitting to 11 violations of state ethics laws and after facing calls for his impeachment earlier in January.
Although winter weather has closed several area businesses and governmental offices, early voting began yesterday as scheduled in Benton County for the special election regarding the creation of a rural emergency medical services district. Tina O'Brien, Benton County Clerk, says she's not certain if the snow prevented many people from casting their votes yesterday.
It is a special election, which is not on the regular election calendar, so to speak, but I'm sure that the weather has played a role in the number of early voters that we have seen. We had 8 here in the Bentonville office yesterday. However, in the Siloam Springs satellite office, we had 22. So that was a pretty good number.
The special election is being held after the Benton County Quorum Court proposed a rural ambulance district, which would add an annual $85 ambulance service fee to rural residents' property tax. County justices of the peace proposed the annual fee as a way to cover the city's increased subsidy requests for providing ambulance service to the county's unincorporated areas. Only rural residents potentially impacted by the proposed ambulance fee can vote in the special election. And O'Brien says there's an easy way to find out whether residents are eligible to vote on the issue.
Now, whether a person is eligible to vote in this election, you know, if they live in the district or not, they can go on to the state website where we have voter view, and they can put in their specific name, and their birth date, and it will pull up where their voting location is, and if they are not eligible, it will also say not eligible.
Early voting continues through Friday and again on Monday at the county clerk's offices in Rogers, Siloam Springs, and Bentonville. 15 precincts will open Tuesday on Election Day. O'Brien suggests that voters double-check their polling location, as some have changed.
The jobless rate in Northwest Arkansas held steady at 4.9% from November to December. That's according to the latest data from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. December's jobless rate was also 0.2% lower than it was in December of 2012, and while the area's labor force grew by about 3,800 people to about 239,000 people from December of 2012 to 2013, that's still about 2,500 fewer people in the workforce than in November. In the Fort Smith metro area, the unemployment rate grew by 0.6% to 7.6% from November to December, though that's still 0.1% lower than the unemployment rate in December of 2012. Meanwhile, the area's overall labor force for December was 132,600, representing a growth of about 400 people from November totals and year-over-year growth of about 1,300 workers.
A special meeting of the Fayetteville City Council has been called for tonight to deal with the agenda from last night's canceled regular meeting of the council. The meeting will take place at the City Administration Building directly following the Ordinance Review Committee meeting scheduled for 5:15 p.m.
Tonight, expect cloudy conditions with a low of 6 and a wind chill as low as negative 7 in northwest Arkansas, and a low of 14 and wind chill as low as 3 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, expect cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow and a high of 19 with a wind chill as low as 3 in northwest Arkansas. There's a 40% chance of snow and a high of 23 and a wind chill as low as 3 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night, expect mostly cloudy conditions with lows from 8 in northwest Arkansas to 17 in the Arkansas River Valley. With the extreme cold that's come with winter this year, staying warm has become a big priority. Unfortunately, some people cannot afford to heat their home. One local organization that can help low-income residents keep their houses heated this winter is the Office of Human Concern. Karen Barrett works with the organization and says the Office of Human Concern is a community action agency that serves Benton, Carroll, and Madison counties.
What we do is we want to make a presence in the community to help people achieve their goals, to help people be more self-sufficient, to be there when they need a helping hand. That's what we are.
One of Barrett's positions at the Office of Human Concern is coordinator for the Low Income Heating, Energy, and Assistance Program, or LIHEAP for short. According to the Administration for Children and Families, the federally funded program helps keep families safe and healthy through initiatives that assist with energy costs. The program assists in managing costs associated with home energy bills and energy crises, as well as weatherization and energy-related minor home repairs. Barrett says the government sets guidelines for this income-based program regarding what the money can be spent on and how much can be spent per household. To apply for assistance, local residents can visit the Office of Human Concern's office in Rogers. Because it is an income-based program, applicants must bring proof of household income for the previous month.
When we add that up and base that upon the household size, then we're able to look at a chart and it tells us how much regular assistance they get. My opinion, the regular assistance is misleading. A lot of people think that that means, oh, regular means I'll get it on a regular basis. That's not the truth. What that means is the person is not in danger of being disconnected. They're not in a crisis situation. They are just applying to get a one-time credit put on whichever bill that they choose. Then we have what is called the crisis program, where people, and right now the biggest thing is propane, they can come in and apply, and if they are below 10% in their propane tank and unable to charge, then we're allowed to get the minimum delivery brought to them.
Barrett says on average, that costs about $639. However, that can fluctuate from household to household. She says they have a set amount they can give someone seeking crisis assistance. In this instance, they can't give more than $500 unless a resident is able to apply a regular assistance payment with that. The price of propane has increased significantly during the last month. According to the United States Energy Information Administration, the average price of propane in the U.S. was about $4 a gallon as of last week. That's about a 45% increase from late December. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, nearly 84,000 households in Arkansas use propane to heat their homes. Barrett says they have most definitely seen an increase of people seeking help this winter. She says they're used to seeing a number of folks on a regular basis, but several new faces have been walking into their office asking for help.
And it's not just because of the propane that I'm finding out. A lot of the people that we are interviewing and seeing, it's households that their unemployment ran out in December. And so there's households with very minimal income. So they're needing help with their large electric bills in addition to their propane bills. So the need is just getting greater every day.
In addition to propane, the program also helps pay for natural gas, electric, and in some instances wood, if the applicant can show their fireplace is their primary source of heat. Since January 6th, Barrett says they have had about 700 customers receive crisis assistance and about 1,800 households receive regular assistance. She says they are going through the money allotted to them through the program very quickly. With only about a third of the money remaining, Barrett says without more funding, this could mean they won't have a summer program. The Office of Human Concern opens at 8 a.m. during weekdays, and interviews are conducted on a first-come, first-served basis. If you come to fill out an application, Barrett requests that people bring a little patience and the correct documentation.
If somebody walks in this office and all they bring is a copy of their bill when we have to prove household income, that will slow the process down, which means if they're going to get a shutoff notice and the majority of the people that come in wait until the day they're going to be disconnected. Then it's up to them to try and get a hold of the utility company to say, I need an extension. I'm trying to work with OHC. They're going to help me pay my bill. Sometimes they're able to get that extension. Sometimes they're not. So our biggest thing of stressing to the public is please pay attention to what we ask you to bring, and please bring it in when you come in.
The Office of Human Concern is located at 506 East Spruce Street in Rogers, and it's open from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. Barrett says interviews end at 2 p.m., so afternoons are the best time to call with questions. The number to call is 636-7301. More information will also be available on the organization's new website, which is set to launch very soon. That address is eohc.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
Jazz is in the air every Friday and Saturday evening from 10 p.m. till 1 a.m. right here on KUAF 91.3 FM. From 10 to midnight, it's Shades of Jazz with yours truly, Robert Ginsberg. Daniel Estes takes you from midnight till 1 a.m. on Saturday morning with Goodnight Jazz, and it's Fred Hall's Swing Thing at midnight on Sundays. America's Music, Jazz, on your NPR station, KUAF.
Valentine's Day is a little over a week away, and one classic gift is a box of chocolates. One local place selling these sweet treats is Martin Greer's Candies in Gateway.
Dad started making candy in 1924 at home on the farm, and he would take his candy to town where they lived close to Texarkana. He would take his candy when they went to sell their produce on Saturdays, and you know. So he did that mainly to get a little spending money, like most teenagers would, you know. They like to have a little spending money, and if you live on the farm, you don't get it.
That story is coming up in about 11 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
The Lincoln Echo, published in Fort Smith, appears to be the last of a long list of African-American newspapers in Arkansas. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the paper has historic roots and is branded as the voice that brings the community together.
Fort Smith counts an estimated 8,000 African-American residents, nearly 10% of the city's population. the second largest black population in western Arkansas after Texarkana. And Fort Smith's black district is growing, up 10% over the past decade. Cecil M. Green Jr. was raised in Fort Smith. He moved away to attend college and worked as an administrator at the University of Chicago and registrar in Knoxville, Tennessee. He retired and moved back to Fort Smith after being away 50 years. Now 81 years old, Cecil Green continues to work as executive vice president of the Lincoln Echo.
When I came to Fort Smith, the Lincoln Echo became available, if you will, and Napoleon Black and two other individuals, we decided... Well, actually, they decided on it, and I said, hey, I'd like to become a part of it. And so I did become a part of the operation because I lived here in Fort Smith, and the other people, other three people involved in it, lived. Two of them lived in California. Napoleon lives in St. Louis, and he commutes down here once a month to put the paper together.
The Lincoln Echo premiered in 1992 as a popular newsletter for the alumni of Lincoln High School, Fort Smith's historic African-American secondary school, which served the region's black children during segregation. The Echo was produced by Sherry Tulliver and Barbara Meadows. Cecil Green is a member of the class of 1948, and his father served as longtime principal.
That was the only education that they could have gotten. And just as a note, the kids from Fayetteville came down. They would spend the entire week in Fort Smith in selected homes, and they would go home on weekends. We also had some students. We were right here on the Oklahoma line, who walked across the Garrison Avenue Bridge, walked across the Arkansas River from Moffitt to go to school here in Fort Smith.
When Tulliver and Meadows decided to sell their newsletter, Napoleon Black, Cecil Green, and several others purchased the brand in 2001, transforming it into a regional newspaper.
Well, we are available to citywide and statewide. Primarily in Fort Smith, we are targeting the African-American community, and one of our goals is to keep people informed about what is going on within our community.
The news office is based at Brunswick Place on 10th Street in downtown Fort Smith. Cecil Green says the paper is bipartisan, but editorially left-leaning.
We try to keep our readers informed about where we've been, where we've come from as a group, and what's going on in the political world.
The Lincoln Echo reprints national and international articles of African-American interest. The paper does not cover crime or breaking news, but prints political, civic, cultural, and historical content, including African tribal history, NAACP news, college graduate profiles, and obituaries in the community.
For example, the church community is very important here in Fort Smith, and we get a lot of people say, will you publicize this event for us, or will you cover this event for us?
The paper has an array of columnists. Aileen Stafford, newspaper office manager, writes about UAFS and current events. Ad manager Danae Burris writes opinion pieces. Tana Holloman, noted Van Buren African-American genealogist, writes a heritage column. The newspaper's politics section features columns by Senators John Bozeman and occasionally Mark Pryor. And each month, Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe submits a column. Fort Smith City Director Andre Good, who is African-American, writes a page titled, Where Do We Stand? Regarding City Politics. The Van Buren Press Argus, owned by the Southwest Times Record, prints the paper paid for by ad revenue. It has a circulation of 3,000. Papers are for sale in places around Fort Smith, as well as in a half dozen newspaper boxes in Little Rock for 50 cents. Subscriptions are $25 a year. The Echo has an online edition and is now on Facebook.
We get quite a few hits, as the terminology goes, from our online edition. And I might mention on the online edition, it is constantly updated.
More than 30 black-owned newspapers have launched in Arkansas over the past 145 years. The Arkansas Freeman began publication in the summer of 1869 and is considered the first. But the most noted is the Arkansas State Press, established in Little Rock in 1941. By civil rights pioneers Lucius Christopher Bates and Daisy Gatson Bates. It remained in circulation until 1997. And like Fort Smith's Lincoln Echo, the Arkansas State Press was the voice of Little Rock Central High during the desegregation crisis of 1957. 13 black newspapers were published in Van Buren and Fort Smith between 1898 and present time. Nationwide, several African-American dailies exist, most notably the Chicago Defender. Now, Napoleon Black believes Black-owned media is critical. He's publisher and co-owner of the Lincoln Echo. He was born and raised in Fort Smith and also attended Lincoln High, graduating in 1959.
It was a self-sustaining community with segregation being the prevalent political. That's the way everything was done. And you had, the as in a lot of ethnic communities, money would and businesses were tailored towards their clientele. And it was self-sustaining, and money would circulate there three, four, five times before it ever left the community. There were five doctors in Fort Smith, five Black doctors in Fort Smith. There was a dentist. There was drug stores. There was all types of businesses. And actually, with integration, all of those businesses went away.
Napoleon Black lives out of state and is retired from AT&T, where he worked as an accounts manager in marketing. He said being raised in a segregated society spurred intense determination amongst his demographic and the desire towards excellence.
And that was the thing that was instilled in us. And at that time, there was an explosion of people, first people that lived in these communities going to college and returning from college and getting jobs. And I know my older brother, when he the first job that he got, he made twice the salary that my father made. And that was because of education. And those were practical things that you could see the results of what education would do. So that was an incentive to go to school and get that. My father was a practical man. He took all his boys down. He was a red cap, which was a person who carried bags for Continental Trailway. And he took us down and had us sit and watch him for 4 hours. He took us down in the morning and just watch him. This is what he did. He said, now, you can go to school and you can do better than I am, or you cannot go to school and I'll get your job right here.
Publisher Napoleon Black pens Poe's thoughts on the editorial page. His brother, the late Alan Black, a prominent Fort Smith resident, served as columnist and editor. As for Cecil Green, his most memorable newspaper issue was the opportunity to cover in person the inauguration of Barack Obama as 44th President of the United States on January 20th, 2009.
We were just very proud of that issue, that edition that we have. And I think we have it posted on a wall down there in the office.
The Lincoln Echo, reporting on history in the making. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can read the online edition at thelincolnecho.com. It is Wednesday, February 5th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I have to read you a lead because I love this lead.
Okay.
Tay Firefly Fisher was made for the game. As a small child, his mother passed him a bounce pass, and 2 decades later, the 5'9" Kingston, New York native is passing the signature red, white, and blue ball to his Harlem Globetrotters teammates.
Are we doing a story about Harlem Globetrotters?
Yes, we're
Yay.
Doing a story
Always
about
fun.
They are coming to Bentonville on Thursday.
Shut up.
Really?
Really?
And this guy's coming with them. This guy is cool.
Well, wait, who is this guy?
His name is Tay Fisher. They call him Firefly.
And he plays for the Globetrotters.
Correct. Right. And he was in school at Siena College in Albany, New York, when they recruited him. The first time he went, he didn't get chosen. He went back a second time, and that time he made the team. And he's been to 50 countries. He's seen the pyramids in Egypt. He's visited the troops in Afghanistan. It's really cool.
I played basketball growing up and always wanted to see them and never did.
And Ditto. Nobody ever invited you to join them either.
No, definitely not.
I wasn't very good.
I wasn't tall enough.
Well, they go out to a lot of schools and do a lot of other things in addition to the performances. But the performance takes place at 7 o'clock Thursday at the Bentonville High School Arena, Tiger Arena, and tickets start at $28. And he says the game only lasts four quarters, but the memories will last a lifetime, which is how I always feel about basketball.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
How important are bees?
Bees are vital to the pollination and production of our fruits and vegetables. Squash, melons, pumpkins, cucumbers.
There's just one problem.
Unfortunately, they're all in trouble.
Everything is connected, from bees to toads to wolves to you. That's on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Listen Sunday at noon to KUAF 91.3 FM.
As you meander down Highway 62, moving east toward Eureka, or southwest to Rogers, just outside of the small town of Gateway, you'll see something you may have seen in the motor tour days of the 1950s, a candy store marked by a 12-foot candy cane holding the sign for Martin Greer's Candies. Inside the white building, Martin Greer II and his son Uriah are carrying on the father-son candy-making tradition that started 90 years ago.
Dad started making candy in 1924 at home on the farm, and he would take his candy to town where they lived close to Texarkana. He would take his candy when they went to sell their produce on Saturdays, and you know. So he did that mainly to get a little spending money, like most teenagers would, you know. They like to have a little spending money, and if you live on the farm, you don't get it.
That next year, Martin Sr. went to work for a candy company in Texarkana, learning the trade from two Greek candy makers and several others over the next few years. After taking a hiatus from candy making during World War II, he opened Mrs. Greer's Candies. As a teenager, Martin recalls his father telling him, "You need a trade, and because I'm a candy maker, you're going to be a candy maker." And in just a couple of years, he was cooking up to 500 pounds of candy each day.
The first 6 years that Silver Dollar City was in existence, from 1960 to 1965, I made it at Dad's place and then took it up there. In fact, I considered it sort of a vacation or a break just to get away from the candy shop and deliver it. But I was also going to school.
In 1965, Greer got his bachelor's degree and went on to teach art for Van Buren Public Schools. He maintained the two careers for much of his 75 years, cooking candy long after his father's death, after school, and on the weekends. His wife and her mother working the candy store while Greer taught. The two are still very instrumental in the family business, in this location that opened in 2000. Martin Greer III declined to become a candy maker. However, he did carry on the teaching gene. It is Greer's 23-year-old son, Uriah, who does much of the cooking these days. Health problems keeping Martin from lifting much and from standing over hot pots of potential candies. In a long room behind glass cases that hold shelves of chocolate-covered cherries, almond toffee, nut clusters, caramel tempters, and over 200 varieties, three banks of tables can be seen. Sunk into the tops of each are what appear to be large metal mixing bowls. In the center of each bowl is a partition separating one side of liquid melted chocolate from an empty one, a wand stirring the melted chocolate and clearing the side of the other.
Okay, this is what is called a tempering pot. You put the cold chocolate in on one side, and it will mix with the warm chocolate on the other side and gets it just to the right temperature where we can dip the centers in there.
Each pot of chocolate holds something different, a dark, a white, a milk, and a sugar-free. The temperatures for each are also different depending on the type, but all gauges lit up in red under the table surface read somewhere over 90 degrees. This cold room, though, is just that, the temperature never going over 65 degrees no matter the weather, the optimum temperature for setting the hand-dipped chocolates and for the unmelted.
The tippering pots are also dipping pots.
We dip not with our hands anymore down into the chocolate, but we use a dipping fork.
Using a wide-pronged fork of sorts, Greer drops a center or nougat to be covered in the milky brown goodness. This is what he calls hand dipping, a process that hasn't been used much since the 1950s, when the process was mechanized with the advent of an enrober. The Greers have one such machine, yet haven't used it in over 8 years. Pretty much anything from a cherry to a marshmallow can be covered in the Peters brand chocolate.
Peters is the one who invented milk chocolate in Switzerland in 1875. We use only Peters chocolate.
According to Peters Chocolate's website, in 1867, Daniel Peter first attempted to make dark chocolate less bitter by adding milk. But it wasn't until several years later, in 1875, that a partnership with his neighbor Henry Nestle led to a variety using powdered milk. Everything from Greer's fondant to the caramel is made in the candy kitchen, a room that can be accessed by leaving the dipping room, passing through a packaging room and a storage area, and down just one step into a large room with windows. Windows that overlook the parking lot and down to Highway 62. Nothing but trees on the other side. Next to the window stands a 99-year-old taffy puller, used mainly in the summer months. From the opposite ceiling and wall hangs a large vent hood over three copper pots that vary in size. Each rests atop a raised gas burner. The largest, a 75-year-old fire mixer.
The reason it's called a fire mixer, it cooks and it mixes at the same time. So we use that mainly for caramel. The small kettles we use for other things. So last night my son cooked almond toffee, and that kettle hadn't been cleaned yet, nor has the slab been cleaned yet, but it'll be cleaned this morning.
Chocolate-covered almond toffee, made with only pure ingredients, happens to be one of the Greer's best sellers. When it has been fully cooked in the kettle, it is moved from the burner and poured onto the slab in the center of the room, the candy maker simply having to turn around. The toffee is then left to rest and harden until it is scored and cut into rectangular pieces to be covered in chocolate. Cream centers are also made in one of the copper candy kettles. When they are cooked, however, the small batch of about 20 pounds is poured into one of two cream beaters, a machine resembling a very large KitchenAid stand-up mixer.
It has to be spotless instantly. It cannot be even a little speck of sugar in there, because it can turn the whole batch back to sugar. Well, both of these are probably about 113, 114 years old. Now, the motors are not that old. We've had to replace the motors.
The recipes are even older, with many of them traceable to the 1890s, though refining and changing to customers' tastes is an ongoing process. All are small batch, hand-dipped, and never frozen. He says that mini boxes made by national companies have been frozen for up to 3 years before they're finally picked up off of store shelf. And if you slice into one of theirs, you'll see just a small layer of chocolate over the center. Greer sweets, however, are 50% chocolate. The number one seller is a turtle-like sweet the Greers call Tempters. Greer, however, says he personally has no favorite.
I'm the kid who grew up in the candy shop, and I have a different one every day.
And in the lobby of this candy store, the Greers are preparing for Valentine's Day. Tables are arranged with red and pink heart-shaped boxes. Some sweets for your sweet. It's a quiet morning at this location just outside of Gateway. And 6 days a week, Martin Greer drives to a Bentonville location, one that just opened up in November. The hope is to grow the business so that young sons Uriah, the current candy maker, and 14-year-old Joseph will be able to carry on this father-to-son tradition. It doesn't take long after Martin opens the doors to this store, which is located in a shopping center just a couple of blocks west of the downtown Bentonville Square, for customers to start strolling in. In the short time I was there, I saw three, one of whom had this to say.
I was here to buy. I had this candy in December for the first time.
Oh.
Best candy I've ever had.
Did you get that?
I did.
You were the TV?
Radio.
With
the public radio station with KUAF.
They got great candy.
For more information or to shop, visit martingreerscandies.com. Remember that Martin Greer II was also an art teacher. The walls in both stores are lined with his paintings and cartoons, some of which were printed in publications such as the Southwest Times Record. Listen for more about Martin Greer's art career on a coming edition of Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Following a top place finish at the Razorback Team Invitational over the weekend, the University of Arkansas women's track and field team moves up to number 6 in the United States Track and Field and Cross Country Coaches Association rankings. The Razorbacks defeated 6 of the nation's top ranked teams over the weekend in record fashion to move up in this week's rankings. The women currently rank 9 performances in the NCAA's top 10. Several athletes will travel to New York this weekend for the Armory Collegiate Invitational before returning to Randall Tyson Track Center to host the Tyson Invitational February 14th and 15th.
For the third consecutive week, the Arkansas men's track and field team is ranked number 1 in the United States Track and Field and Cross Country Coaches Association rankings. The men have won all 3 meets so far this season, boasting several top NCAA performances. The Razorbacks have combined for 9 current top 10 finishes this season. The Razorbacks will send several athletes to Albuquerque this weekend to compete at New Mexico before returning to Randall Tyson Track Center to host the Tyson Invitational February 14th and 15th.
Yesterday, we mentioned several visual arts events happening in the region, and today we have a few more to share with you. Saturday, the gallery known as Bottle Rocket, located on the edge of Fayetteville, will premiere a new exhibit called Gray Zone. The work is by Detroit-based artist Merit Peransky, hope I got that right, who is originally from Ukraine and grew up just 60 miles from Chernobyl. He was born just 2 months before the nuclear disaster there. Gray Zone is described as an assembly of objects and images that together form an archive museum. It's part art and part history and science. The exhibit lasts until early March and will then be shown at Detroit Contemporary after that. You can find out more at facebook.com/bottlerocketartgallery.
Don Lee, an associate professor of art at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith, is exhibiting many of his works, drawing and three-dimensional selections, at the Center for Art and Education in Van Buren. That's this month. The work included can be described as drawings, paintings, and/or sculpture. The Center for Art and Education is in Van Buren at 104 North 13th Street. And still up at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum is a display of Valentines from the past. That exhibit runs through April.
Later this month, the University of Arkansas Department of Art will feature work and a lecture by Cynthia Norse Thompson, a new associate professor. Her work addresses her experiences as a young woman raised in the religious South. She previously served for 12 years as professor of book and paper arts at Memphis College of Art and the chair of the Fine Arts Department for 1 year. On Thursday the 27th, she'll discuss her work at 5:30 p.m. in the Fine Arts Building on the U of A campus.
If you're looking for a reason to get out of the house during the next couple of days, there are a few events lined up, weather permitting. The 2014 Transition Fair is scheduled for 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. tomorrow evening at the Bentonville High School South Commons. The purpose of the event is to assist in linking students to life after graduation. Students, parents, and teachers are welcome to attend. All secondary students receiving special education and or 504 services are encouraged to attend. For more information, call 696-3437.
Eureka Springs Fire Department, EMS, celebrated 130 years of service to the city last year. This weekend, they will again host the annual First Responder Conference. The Midwest First Responder Conference will take place Friday through Sunday at the Best Western Inn of the Ozarks in Eureka Springs. Guest experts from Arkansas and surrounding states will share their knowledge during 3 parallel tracks of the conference. The conference is open to all members of fire and EMS services in the region. Registration is $25 but increases to $35 Friday. More information is available at eurekaspringsfire.org.
At 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon, Steve Dunlap, Northwest Region Education Coordinator for Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, will speak at Hobbs State Park on one of the most influential Native American tribes in Arkansas, the Osage. The Osage tribe inhabited a large area which included all of northwest Arkansas. The Osage were good stewards of the wildlife in their hunting lands. The program, which is free and open to the public, is part of the Friends of Hobbs monthly speaker series. For more information, call 479-789-5000.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last night, I Love Lucy Live on Stage opened at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Shows will continue through Sunday. Bill Mendieta is taking on the role of Ricky Ricardo in the show, which he says is a love letter to I Love Lucy and classic television. This morning, the San Francisco native stopped by Studio 123 to discuss the show. During our conversation, I asked if Bill grew up in an artistic family.
My family, I have a big family. Six brothers and sisters growing up, all were involved in the arts. My parents are very musical. My mother used to teach accordion when she met my dad, and my dad taught himself every musical instrument, played in bands and all that, really loved it, and they danced all the time. And let's see, I have an older sister that's a harpist. She does albums out and performs all around the country. And I have a brother that's a visual artist and a very good chef. That's very artistic. And another brother who taught himself classical piano, and he was an Arthur Murray dance teacher. He did flamenco and physical training. He does it all. He's a very good mechanic as well.
So,
and a locksmith. And then I had a sister that was a ballet dancer and a flamenco dancer, and another sister that was in the Conservatory of Music for opera, and she sings musical theater and stuff. Now she has kids, but yeah, and a foster brother that played lead guitar in a band and.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was very, very supportive, and there was always something to do, so it was never a dull moment.
Well, it sounds like it runs in the family.
Yeah.
Never a dull moment for sure, and it doesn't seem like there's really been a dull moment in your career. I mean, a couple of years ago, you actually originated this role of Ricky Ricardo. What is it like to originate a role? I mean, how have things changed?
That's an interesting question. Well, and this role, obviously, Desi Arnaz originated the role in the series, and what we're taking here is a we're doing a live representation of those scripts, actual scripts from the I Love Lucy show that we were able to license from CBS, and to put it in a theater format where the audience gets to travel back in time and they get to be that studio audience of the 1950s. It was a lot of fun because coming from the beginning, it changed. It was originally going to be a proof of concept, and when I auditioned for it, it was supposed to be 3 weeks of rehearsal, and we'll video it in front of a live audience, and then they could use that as a promo to see if this would be a product that would work. Ended up building to be more, and so we had developed that show in Los Angeles and put it up and to see if audiences would come, and right away it was sold out. Right away, and they had thousands on a waiting list in our little theater in Los Angeles, and it was really amazing to see the response that so many people would come across the country, a couple from England and some from Canada, came to see this show. And being able to develop that with the director and with the cast and with the producers and one of our writers, Kim Flagg, and Rick Sparks, our director, collaborated on some of the material that's new, that's not of the I Love Lucy scripts, mm-hmm. written by Jess Oppenheimer and Bob Carroll Jr. and Madeline Pugh. So all this together for this concept of bringing the audience back in time to have an experience of what it might have been like to be there to watch this iconic show at the time, which was very groundbreaking. It was the first show that was done in front of a live audience with that three-camera shoot that they use in sitcoms today. So back to your question, what's it like developing this show? It was an honor and a great respect for the creators of the show and the creators of these roles as we tried to do justice to what's being expected of us in putting this up. We knew we'd be under the microscope. So, and we knew that, you know, we're not, I'm not Desi Arnaz. I'm not, you know, Serena Irwin's not Lucille Ball. And all the characters, all the original actors were just so perfect for those roles. So our job was to hit those expectations and yet still be true with ourselves as actors. So now it is Bill Mendieta doing Ricky Ricardo and Serena Irwin doing Lucy Ricardo and so on. And developing that, it's fun. And then we had three iterations. We did it in Chicago and with with some different cast changes from wonderful local actors from Chicago. And then in the national tour, we took some of our actors from Chicago, some of our actors from L.A., and we brought in some new people. And it creates a whole new feel to the show. And they're all wonderful performers as well and wonderful people. So it's an interesting energy because when we do it again, there's other developments and other things that we find, oh, well, this works. This might work better than what we did way back in L.A. Mm-hmm. And there's some things that were so wonderful to see the effect in L.A. in a small theater. We see it in a bigger theater in Chicago, and here we see it on tour with multiple thousands and thousands of people in the audience, and it's exciting. It's exciting to see it.
Well, playing an iconic character like Ricky Ricardo, do you find that it's more helpful because you have all this tape to look at because, you know, there's this person you have to be this way because this is what people remember? Or is it daunting because this is the way people remember this person and you are a little concerned of, you know, about putting your own spin on things because this character is this character?
Right, right. Good question. A little bit of both, actually. Mm-hmm. It is you see what's been done and you see what's there and you see what works. And you attempt to hit those things that people expect. And then at some point I had to, you know, either stop watching the episodes and let this live within me as we're developing it. And we see what moments happen for real here on stage between me and the other actors. And we create something new. Oh, this is another funny bit that we can do that wasn't in the show. But let's see if that's possible and see if the audience reacts. And that's our test, is the audience, the ultimate test, if they laugh or not, or if they're enjoying themselves or not. So it is an interesting thing. I'd approach it to, okay, this has an accent, have to do that. It's from Cuba, so you have to be very specific with that type of accent. And even when I speak Spanish, that type of Spanish, or sing it too. And so I don't sound too much like a gringo. That's part of the challenge. And then to hit those things very well and do my work on the character, okay, where's the mindset coming from? Coming from Cuba, coming to America, wants the American dream, has a beautiful American wife, but she wants to get in the act. So you have that constant dynamic and conflict with them. And growing up in the 30s and 40s to the late 20s to the 50s to where his age is then at that time. What is that mentality? What was going on in the world then? So I did all my research and had fun enjoying and doing that research. And then getting into part of, well, why does he want to be a band leader? Why does he want to be a singer, an entertainer? And then going into that feeling of when I'm on stage. And it's the same feeling as a performer when I'm on stage in front of the audience with the band behind me singing some of these songs. It's one of the funnest things in the world. And he said, yes, this is it. This is that high that brings people back to perform again and again and again. So getting in touch with those aspects as opposed to putting a carbon copy on what Desi Arnaz did or on Desi Arnaz, that became the focus for me to have and the room for me to be how Bill Mendieta operates in the moment-to-moment of Ricky Ricardo. And then I looked at, you know, if you look at a lot of the great performances in films, like Anthony Hopkins doing Nixon, doing Alfred Hitchcock, you know, Robert Downey Jr. doing Chaplin, and some of these people that have to play well-known characters, And they really, and they when they do it successfully, I mean, Kate Blanchett, when she did in Aviator, she did Kate Hepburn. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, wow, that's a daunting task. But how do you do that and make that authentic so people can let that go once they come into the audience? And we hope they do that. We provide that for them. When they come in, sure, everybody's like, what are they going to do with I Love Lucy? That's my favorite show. What are they going to do with that? And they come on in and they see us and we kind of feel them kind of jumping on the ride and saying, okay, we're in good hands. Let's go on this ride and see what happens. And then they give in, and that's the beauty of theater. You get to suspend your disbelief and ride on that journey.
Well, you mentioned the audience. They're very much a part of the show. How is it for you as an actor to kind of break that fourth wall?
Oh, it's fun. I love it. I love it because it's and there's times that we don't, and there's times that we do, and those are very, very specific. But there's an awareness of the audience, too, an awareness of the laughters and allowing the proper room for those. And the audience is an important character to every theatrical production. It gets to be more here because they're actually encouraged and treated like a studio audience. So great, you can stomp your feet, you can laugh, you can do all this stuff. We'll have an applause sign to give you some cues if you want. So come participate. And sometimes many of the audiences who remember the commercials of the day or the show, they would sing along with the jingles. And you hear, wow, this is kind of cool. This is... Everyone's getting into it. They're coming along with us on the ride, or they're applauding when the band is coming out and doing their things. It's a joy. It's a kick.
That was Bill Mendieta, who portrays Ricky Ricardo in I Love Lucy on stage, which will continue its run at the Walton Arts Center through Sunday. He stopped by KUAF this morning. More information about the show is available at waltonartscenter.org.
Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs through a collective voice. And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Alpena.
Now, we did mention a couple of events that are coming up. I do want to mention one that has been canceled. Due to the forecast for inclement weather, the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra concert that was scheduled for Saturday has been canceled. The significant threat of snow and ice the day of the concert, as well as the 2 days prior, is raising safety concerns for musicians and patrons. The board of the APO regrets this decision, but feels it's the best in the best interest for all concerned. Organizers don't think they'll be able to reschedule the event. However, they have invited Roberto Plano to come back next season. For more information, you can call 841-4644. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Graham.
I'm Christina Thomas.
You can tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back along with her co-host Kyle Kellums.
I will.
To end today's show, we're going to have some music by Nickel Creek. The song is called Destination, and it is on their upcoming album. Earlier this week, they announced that after 9 years, they're releasing a new album, and I had a bunch of friends very excited about this, so I thought I would go ahead and play this song for you. They do have some festival dates and concerts this summer, and some of those tickets will go on sale Friday. You can find out more at nickelcreek.com. Again, thanks for listening, and have a great Wednesday. You look like it's so far.